So my name's Ophelia Field, and I work for English Pen, which, for those of you who don't know, is a writers' association. It started here in England in 1921, but it's now all around the world. And my program, the Writers in Prison program, supports persecuted and imprisoned writers in virtually every country of the world, and campaigns on their behalf, and writes letters to them in prison, and sends them books and money and things to their families in prison. And so today we're reading from an anthology called Another Sky, Voices of Conscience from Around the World, which is a collection of work by imprisoned and persecuted writers that Penn has helped over the years since the 1970s. You're about to hear extracts from the book read by Rosie Boycott, James Flint, Marcel Theroux, Alexander Masters, and Carmela Shamsi. And the book will be available in the bookshop, or is available in the bookshop. We'd like to thank you for coming, but most of all, we'd like to pay tribute to the writers whose stories you're about to hear, and to all the other writers in the book, and those writers around the world whose freedom continues to be threatened.
Good afternoon. I'm up first, I think, on this on this sequence, so I'll get started. Is the level all right for you guys? Okay. I'm James Flint, and I'm going to read an extract by Reza Barahini, a poet, novelist, and short story writer. He was born in Tabriz, Iran, in 1935, and was imprisoned both by the Shah in the 1970s and by the Islamic Republic of Iran in the 1980s. The following extract recounts one horrific night Barahini spent in Iran's notorious Evan prison. A minor mistake in Evan prison. The cold weather did not hurt at all. There must be stars up in the freezing sky, I thought. If only the blindfold were removed. We were ordered to walk, and walk we did, slowly and precariously, hunched up, subhuman beings, each with the hope in mind of one day straightening his back and looking up at the sky with free, open eyes. But this was not normal. Where were the minibuses? We were walking on rough ground. There was silence, it was dark, and I sensed the dim streaks of something like flashlights or meteorites in the sky. Where are they taking us? I feel a strange pressure on my shoulder from the hand of the man behind me, but I cannot stop talking. Where are they taking us? Others don't speak. I hear the barking of a dog in the distance and the coughing of someone nearby. And then the man from behind me says, "Don't you know? I've always been taken to my cell after interrogation. We never walked. They took us in the minibus." "We were in court," the man said. "We're taken to be shot." "What? You mean you weren't in court with us?" "No, I wasn't in court." "I must have put my hand on the shoulder of the wrong man in the confusion. You must have done the same. There were too many people there." I don't know what to do. My whole mind is a vegetable. I tried to call out to the guards. I have no voice. Cold sweat is running down all over me. "Have they marked the soles of your feet?" "What? Have they marked the soles of your feet?" "No." "They've marked the soles of our feet with a marker that we're to be shot." "I've no such things on the soles of my feet." "What are you waiting for? Just shout out and tell them." This time I did shout at the top of my voice, "Guard, there's been a mistake. I wasn't in court. Come and look at the soles of my feet." "Shut up, you bastard infidel." The man from behind says, "Keep screaming. Tell them to come and look at the soles of your feet." I scream. I don't know what I'm saying, but I know that I'm fighting for my life. My hand is still on the shoulder of the man walking ahead of me. "Take off your shoes and scream. Tell them about the soles." The man from behind me is the only one who speaks. He doesn't think of himself at all. What kind of a human being is he? "Come and look at the soles of my feet," I scream, trying to take off my shoe. But it is impossible with my hand on someone's shoulder and someone else's hand on my shoulder. Anyway, how can I show the soles of my feet to anyone in the dark? "It's impossible, it's impossible," I whisper. "Do what you can to stay alive. We've lost our lives, perhaps for a reason, but why should you lose yours?" I scream, thinking that it would be an honor to die beside this man. "You godless bastard! You think you can save your skin by screaming? I'll show you when I shoot you myself in 10 minutes. But come and look at the soles of my feet. See for yourself. I wasn't in court. I was being interrogated by Haji Aga Hassani the whole day. The interrogation isn't finished yet. Why don't you believe me? Don't tire. Scream, the man whispers. And I scream. I scream no matter what. And the guard swears. And we reach the final destination. We are all panting. There are many flashlights. There are many people talking in whispers. Some of them must be the firing squad. Others are there too, perhaps as spectators, to see what would happen to them if they didn't recant and betray their friends. They have to see the face of death to make up their mind. Brother Pastor, please come and look at the soles of my feet. You will see that I was not condemned to death. Shut up! A voice louder than anything before reverberates in the silence. Someone says, I want you to remove the blindfold before shooting me. I want to see the Knight of Tehran once more before I die. Shut up, that's all. There are two men crying in the distance. One of them keeps saying, God, is this the end of my life? Then I sense the hurried streaking of the flashlights. Perhaps it is not the fear of death that is so horrible. It is the waiting itself for death. The flashlight moves closer, spreading its light on the ground. The man is taking off his shoes. Then someone tells him to put on his shoes. I hear him replace his shoes. Then it is my turn. I tell the guard bending before me to examine the soles of my feet to see for himself that there has been a mistake. But he doesn't let me go on. He calls out, Hassan, come and take this man to the courthouse and have them mark the soles of his feet. I put my shoes back on. Someone grabs my hand and pulls me away. He keeps me blindfolded and starts to run, making me run blindly downhill. He doesn't ask questions, but I keep telling him that I am innocent, and I keep thinking that running like this might even result in an earlier death, before one by firing squad. Scribbling something on the sole of my foot equals death. How dangerous writing can be. The man pulling me over the craggy path doesn't say anything. How long it takes to get there. When we finally stop and enter the courthouse, my head goes dizzy and I am about to throw up. What is this? They are having soup. I remember having had soup once when we delayed in the interrogation room. I also remember the jokes about the soup, said to have been made by the head chef of the Hilton Hotel, who had been arrested. I begin to shout at the top of my voice that I haven't been to court and I'm innocent. Hassan calls out to someone else, asking him to come and mark my foot. The man comes over and the first thing he asks me for is my name. I hear him going through something like a file. Hold him right there, he says, and departs. A minute later, there is chaos in the lobby of the courthouse. They have ordered everyone to take off their shoes. Then I hear a clapping of hands. No, it is a slap on someone's face. It feels as if someone is being beaten up. There are people running, and suddenly someone is pushed up before my very nose. Let go of him. Take this one up. The grip on my wrist loosens. I would very much like to see the face of the man who is going to be taken up the craggy path. He is breathing hard. He smells of the soup he has just eaten. We stand only for a minute, facing each other in the dark, with the smell of his mouth reaching my nostrils. Then they depart. I stand there. A few minutes later, someone takes my hand and leads me to a corner and tells me to sit down. Through the gap underneath the blindfold, I see a half-eaten bowl of soup with an aluminium spoon in it. I can hear others eating. The man stands by me for some time, then he says, Eat! I take the spoon, and when I'm about to raise it to my mouth, I hear the shots, loud and clear. I put the spoon back in the bowl. Thank you very much.
Gaito is a Tibetan... Sorry, start again. Gaito is a Tibetan poet who fled his country for India. He's published poems and articles about Tibetan culture in Tibetan, Chinese, and English magazines, and he's translated stories from English into Tibetan. To is also the editor of a popular quarterly literary magazine. Today, he remains in India, where he's an executive member of the Tibetan Writers Abroad Center of Penn. And this poem is called Once I Had a Home. Once I had a home, a paradise called Sun City Lhasa. Once I knew a peaceful moon and blue sky. My home is like an ocean of peace in their eyes. Once I had a home. My home is the tears for the torn tents of the Red Ravage. Now the yak boys, buttermilk, fled. plucked from their land like green corn or golden flames of fury. They have become the dispossessed, lost not nomads. They tramped listless, fruitless farmers. Sunrise and sunset, year after year. The fields of green turn yellow to green again. But my home is brooding, blood red, the tears of Yalong River. My home's a mother's mourning, O Patola. My home is her love from across the frontier. My home is prison and a death sentence. My home is jail. What did I know of rights and freedom? I don't want to know. But just one thing, look, give me back my life again, please. One lifetime to live as I please, whether it's old age or disease, in a peaceful world.
Hello. I'm going to read an extract from a piece written by Anna Politkovskaya. I just want to say a couple of sentences about who Anna Politkovskaya was and what she did. She was a reporter for a Russian newspaper called Novaya Gazeta at a time when government control was clamping down on what journalists can and can't say in Russia, and when there's a great restrictions on freedom of speech. And she reported fearlessly and tirelessly on the war in Chechnya at a time when really people weren't interested in touching the subject. In Russia, because it was verboten, and in this country, I think, because there was a fatigue about it and it was a very dangerous place to go. And she would keep going and keep writing about it in a way that made her very unpopular, and Russians that I know felt she was a hysteric and was banging on about these things that they felt weren't very important. So in October 7th last year, she was killed. She was assassinated in her Moscow apartment, almost certainly because of what she'd been writing about Chechnya. And as time has passed since then, she's looking less and less hysterical and more prophetic. And this essay was written just a few weeks before she died. I am a pariah. That is the main result of my journalism throughout the years of the Second Chechen War and of publishing abroad a number of books about life in Russia and the Chechen War. In Moscow, I'm not invited to press conferences or gatherings which officials of the Kremlin might attend, in case the organizers are suspected of harboring sympathies towards me. Despite this, all the top officials talk to me at my request when I'm writing articles or conducting investigations, but only in secret, where they can't be observed, in the open air, in squares, in secret houses which we approach by different routes like spies. The officials like talking to me. They're happy to give me information. They consult me and tell me what is going on at the top, but only in secret. You don't get used to this, but you learn to live with it. It is exactly the way I've had to work throughout the Second War in Chechnya. First, I was hiding from the Russian federal troops, but always able to make contact clandestinely with individuals through trusted intermediaries so that my informants would not be denounced to the top generals. When Putin's plan of Chechenization succeeded, setting good Chechens loyal to the Kremlin to killing bad Chechens who opposed it, the same subterfuge extended to talking to good Chechen officials, whom of course I had known for a long time, and many of whom, before they were good officials, had sheltered me in their homes in the most trying months of the war. Now we can meet only in secret, because I am a pariah, an enemy, indeed an incorrigible enemy, not amenable to re-education. People in Chechnya are afraid for me, and I find that very touching. They fear for me more than I fear for myself, and that is how I survive. I am not really a political animal. I have not joined any party and would consider it a mistake for a journalist, in Russia at least, to do so. I have never felt the urge to stand for the Duma, although there were years when I was invited to. So what is the crime that has earned me this label of not being one of us? I have merely reported what I have witnessed, no more than that. I have written, and less frequently, I have spoken. I'm even reluctant to comment because it reminds me too much of the imposed opinions of my Soviet childhood and youth. It seems to me our readers are capable of interpreting what they read for themselves. That is why my principal genre is reportage, sometimes, admittedly, with my own interjections. I'm not an investigating magistrate, but someone who describes the life around us for those who cannot see it for themselves. Because what is shown on television and written about in the overwhelming majority of newspapers is emasculated and doused with ideology. People know very little about life in other parts of their own country, and sometimes even in their own region. The Kremlin responds by trying to block my access to information. It's ideologists supposing that this is the best way to make my writing ineffectual. It is impossible, however, to stop someone fanatically dedicated to this profession of reporting the world around us. My life can be difficult, more often humiliating. I am not, after all, that young at 47 to keep encountering rejection and having my own pariah status rubbed in my face. But I can live with it. I will not go into the other joys of the path I have chosen, the poisoning, the arrests, the threats in letters and over the internet, the telephone death threats, the weekly summonses to the Procurator General's office to sign statements about practically every article I write, the first question being, how and where did you obtain this information? Of course, I don't like the constant derisive articles about me which appear in other newspapers and on internet sites which have long presented me as the mad woman of Moscow. I find it disgusting to live this way. I would like a bit more understanding. The main thing, however, is to get on with my job, to describe the life I see, to receive visitors every day in our editorial office who have nowhere else to bring their troubles because the Kremlin finds their stories off message, so that the only place they can be aired is in our newspaper, Novaya Gazeta.
Cuban poet and founder of the Independent Journalists Association, Indemiro Restano, was arrested in Havana in 1991 and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment for rebellion. He was also accused of preparing printed material inciting civil disobedience and actions against socialist society and distributing counter-revolutionary propaganda. The following poem, entitled Prison, was written in November 1993. Mother, do you know where your poet is? Well, they have dragged me into a dark, narrow, lonely cell. And do you know why, Mother? For not allowing fear to carry me away. But I am not completely alone, Mother. I have got to know a good friend here. A small spider visits me every day and spins in the door of my cell. When the guard comes, I let it know so it hides away and doesn't get killed. I wanted to live, Mother, because I know that it has inside it something that I also possess. However, it seems that the guard does not know this. Mother, do you know where your poet is? Well, they have dragged me to a cold, narrow, lonely cell. And do you know why, Mother? Because the poet is the only person who never forgets the meaning of freedom. Another Cuban poet named Angel Cuadra was arrested in 1967 and accused of working against the state. He served his full 15-year sentence before being released and going to exile in the United States. During his time at Milana Dos labor camp in Havana, he wrote the following poem entitled, Also at Night. Meanwhile, the night passes and silence starts its monotonous drill, which is the daily round of this idleness, the continuing corrosion of this wrong. How is it possible that nothing breaks down? That equilibrium continues as a fixed category, like a nail in place. That life culpably persists, and every day these obscure lives are being buried meter by meter. And the wire enclosures, the symphony of the shackles, the watchful rifles in unpunished collusion grossly raise asthmatic, sarcastic faces. Because they are burying little by little these lives where were useful assets in the total yield of the world. How can it be that God has less power than this evil, that hatred is jubilant, unpunished? Alas, poor disabled God.
Ken Saro-Wiwa was hanged in Nigeria on 10th of November 1995. He'd been an outspoken critic of Nigeria's successive military governments and one of Nigeria's most beloved writers. Poet, novelist, and screenwriter, his work won both critical and popular acclaim. This passage is taken from the last television interview conducted with Ken Saro-Wiwa before his imprisonment and execution. In England, writers write to entertain. They raise questions of individual existence. But for a Nigerian writer, in my position, you can't go into that. Literature has to be combative. You cannot have art for art's sake. This art must do something to transform the lives of a community, of a nation. And for that reason, literature has a different purpose altogether in that sort of society. What is of interest to me is that my art should be able to alter the lives of a large number of people, of a whole community, of an entire country, so that my literature has to be entirely different. The stories that I tell must have a different sort of purpose from the artist in the Western world. And art in that instance becomes so meaningful both to the artist and to the consumers of that art, because you do not just depend on them to read your books, you even have to live a life that they can emulate. The second extract comes from a letter to International Pen, dated 12th of May, 1995. Whether I live or die is immaterial. It is enough to know that there are people who commit time, money, and energy to fight this one evil among so many others predominating worldwide. If they do not succeed today, they will succeed tomorrow. We must keep on striving to make the world a better place for all of mankind, each one contributing his bit in his or her own way. I salute you all.
And we thank you all for coming in here and staying to listen. If your conscience has been pricked by any of these voices of conscience and you would like to find out more about PEN, about joining PEN or making a donation to our work on behalf of writers and journalists such as these, come and find me. I'll be standing just outside the tent here after this, and or take a look at our website, which is englishpen.org, or have a look at the book Another Sky, which is in the bookshop. Many thanks.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That was Rosie Boycott, Alexander Masters, Marcel Threw, James Flint, Camilla Chamsey, and Ophelia Field. Thank you very much. Please, thank you. That's what I was pushing for.